When I say urban farming, what do you picture? That probably depends a lot on who you are. Maybe you picture an old hippie with wild, long gray hair tilling the soil on a vacant lot. Or maybe you picture recent college grads with time on their hands and a taste for beets and arugula. But how about a family farm in the heart of the city trying to feed a community?
We're building a fence for the ghosts to go around so they're not tearing up the fruit trees because they've been eating the fruit trees and we have to have those grow. So right now they're scattered around.
How many goats are there?
Four.
Yeah.
Four. Two black and two colorful.
A few kids are hard at work on a Saturday afternoon chasing goats.
Where did they go?
The goats actually help them maintain a garden.
We have them like to keep like the grass and things like that down so we don't have to do it. Because, I mean, all that was pretty much tall today. Now they've been out all day.
But there's plenty of other work to do. Inside a greenhouse structure, there are rows of pools filled with baby tilapia. And overhead are baby sprouts floating in rafts.
That gotta be help.
Right here.
Outside, a garden bed overflows with produce for the community. Anyone who passes by can help themselves to zucchini, melons, tomatoes.
Look how much I can lay out.
We can fry the what?
Green ones.
What's the green pepper?
Blow their mouth up.
What's that?
I don't know. Mama! What's this?
Kale.
It's kale.
Kale in a food desert. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And today, we're going to meet urban farmers in Kansas City who are innovating, problem-solving, and doing surprising things in their communities, from the woman determined to grow 100,000 pounds of produce on Kansas City's east side to an engineer trying to change the food system itself. Let's start with Keisha Johnson, whose operation we just visited near 29th and Prospect. Hi, Keisha.
Good morning.
That was your daughter discovering kale?
Yes. And she eats the beets like they're apples. She's amazing.
She just bites right into the beets?
Bites right into. First, she washes them. She lets you know you need to wash them. But yes, she's like one of our little rabbits. She eats all the veggies over there.
Your garden is attached to a pretty ambitious city farm, a nonprofit with a goal of growing 100,000 pounds of produce in a food desert.
Yes, ma'am.
Tell me about that goal. Where did it come from?
Oh, it came from Trey. He has...
Who's that?
His name is Gary Taylor. And he has like a box of dreams for kids, and I don't know where he pulls them from. But we continue to have kids in the neighborhood plant the vegetables. And I think once they start growing the vegetables, they start liking them. Because at first they don't like tomatoes, and they don't like greens. They're like, you know, you have to add a whole bunch of seasonings to them. But they eat them fresh out the vine. And as Mouse Demand Group, contribute to growing and doing the aquaponic system that we also have too that carries the fish along with feeding the fish and feeding the vegetables. They are like a rotating system, like a big fish tank is what I would say.
So explain aquaponics to me.
Aquaponics is a system to where the fish feeds the veggies off of the bacteria they have. They eat like any, like we have some gold coils in there now, goldfish coils in there. And what happens with that is they didn't have any food. We didn't feed them anything. Dre brought in this duckweed. This is a duckweed. It has a horrible smell. So instead of providing the fish with that, they was eating like the fungus and stuff off the side, the algae, off the sides of the tarp. So we made that. We try to use that to test to see if the water was warm enough, cool enough, if it has been, you know, tainted with anything, and it hasn't. It wasn't nothing wrong with that. So we put the little tilapia in there Thursday, and it's 12,000 of them floating.
12,000 tilapia.
Yes. So the ways to feed the veggies on the floating rafts, and anything coming from the veggies to feed the fish, and so it's like a rotating system.
How did this whole farm begin?
Well, I think it began in his backyard, and he just thought, like, well, I'm going to teach these young boys how to do this. And so they can explain the hydroponics just like an adult can. They're from ages of 7 to 17, and they come in, and they taught me, basically, what aquaponics was. Really, hydroponics is where you don't have the fish like that.
But your relationship with it began with the land itself, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Tell me that story.
My grandfather had that land over there for about 50 years. It's a daycare right across the street from it. And they've had that. They also started a league called the Kansas City Keys. He was the original co-founder of that. And it just grew. And he stopped working there. They closed the daycare. So the land was just sitting. And it was like, okay, well, Dre Taylor came and met my cousin DeAndre Johnson. And they all got kicked off from there.
Well, did you grow up around this plot of land?
Yes.
Tell me about what you've seen in the neighborhood, just your upbringing and maybe how it's changed.
Well, it has changed tremendously. We've had a lot of shootings, killings. We one block off Prospect, so everyone's aware of what Prospect is. You know, it's a lot of high traffic and violence and drugs and all that. And it broke down the community to where people can actually come together and sit outside and see goats on a forum. Like, goats, what is, you know, like, is that a real chicken? And they're excited. And then we have people come out on Saturdays from 10 to 4 that can help volunteer to plant, eat, and just, you know, really get to meet their neighbors. Because, you know, a lot of them just sit on the porch. But now that we have that there, they're actually coming to the meeting point, like, hi, you know. And I've been there for, like, about, I'm 37. Sorry, 38. And
it's easy to forget a birthday.
But, I haven't known some of those people around the neighborhood. Me living there all that long, you know, they had stayed there that long. But I'm like, oh, hi. She's like, well, I lived there for 20 years. I'm like, have you? I'm like, about one block up. I'm like, oh, so now I see you. And you got kids. And their kids are coming down there. They want to work until like 9 o'clock at night. Like, Keisha, Miss Keisha, do we have something we can do? You know, can we shovel? Can we put? I'm like, okay, yeah, sure. I got plenty of work, you know, so they love it.
So did you have any experience gardening before you got involved with finding, basically, there were new people on your family's land and you got to know them and got involved? Was that your true introduction to gardening?
Actually, it's never to that extreme. My grandmother came from the South, so we was always planting like tomatoes and potatoes and little small things, never to this extreme. Like, but I just always loved dirt, so I had no problem with learning something different, a little bit more, so yeah.
How has it changed your life to be running this garden?
It's beautiful. It's like a sanctuary, like, you know, tranquility. It's very peaceful. It's meditating. Even though it's a lot of work, I work by myself a lot. I love it. I love to hear the flow of the water, you know. It's beautiful.
We heard your daughter and we heard some other neighborhood kids, but what has it been like for your family? I mean, when did you start doing this?
I started doing this in like 2016, the beginning of 2016. I was around the project, but we wasn't really up off the ground. But
so like in the last year, has your family changed?
Yeah, it has. It's good and bad, you know, it's bittersweet, but it's brought us closer together. My grandparents come out. They used to stay in the house and play cards and dominoes. My grandfather, he waters the plants in the morning, and they love it. So I think it's an okay thing for us. I think we're getting to the point to where we used to have a lot of situations with this land, you know, in
like,
the beginning.
What kind of situations?
Well, we had a problem with the deed and the owners and, you know, a lot of different things I won't discuss on here without him being present. But it's all in calm down. It's all settled. Water on the bridge, but I think it's kind of like brought our family closer. You know, something that divides a situation or a family apart, it has a tendency to bringing them back closer, regardless of the trials and tribulations that you go through.
Well, yeah, I mean, is the stuff that you were saying you don't want to go into more detail on, is that what you mean by when you say bittersweet, like the bitter part?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's lovely. We're growing. We're going to keep growing. And I don't have any plans on going anywhere anytime soon. So,
what did you do before this came along?
Johnson Child Care, the daycare across the street. Then I had children. And I was like, well, I don't want to bring my work home with me. So I got away from that and I got into the H&R Block with taxes and stuff. So, man, I'm not more of a, I'm not a desk woman.
Can you talk to me about this whole thing as a business? I mean, you've been treating the garden as kind of a pantry for anyone who passes by.
Correct.
Are people taking advantage of that?
Yes. Yes, especially when it comes to those green tomatoes. So we have like rows of green tomatoes. Like I'm gonna say we probably have about 50 tomato plants out there right now. And if you drive down the area, you'll see that it's a stand over here for 5 green tomatoes, but the guy wants $7 for them. So people come through for that and kale and arugula. I'm not a big fan of arugula, but they love it. So whatever they love, I keep planting. So we just keep it in rotation. We got more cool climate plants coming out like broccoli. So we're going to be harvesting all year round, outside and indoors.
So how do you let people know that they can just come take this stuff? Are there big signs or something?
Not yet. We have another firm working on that, another group working on that with us. But normally just stop and ask because it's outside. It's not fenced in. They're like, okay, can we have that? And I'm like, sure. And then I explain to them what this is because they're like, what is this in here? Like, they've never seen, like, something that big. Like, wow. Like, in the urban area, though, you know, you'd be looking for this to be in Lee Summit or Overland Park, but it's one block off of Prospect. So like I was saying, it kind of turns the heads back like, well, wow. And then their kids is growing these plants. They go back home like, mommy, I did this. I did that. I was like, oh, okay, did you, baby? He's like, yeah. And they be happy. Like, they come down here and pick out grass and stuff. They weed and everything. They're magnificent. So,
but for a business, is it sustainable to keep maintaining a garden full of food that you give away? I mean, yes. I realize it's a nonprofit, but
we have a lot of volunteers come out. Yes, and I appreciate them so much because they help me out a tremendous. But as long as they come, we give, you know. And even if they don't come, we're still going to give. I always work it out.
We've talked about this being a food desert. I mean, what are the options, other options for getting food nearby?
Yeah, some of the churches have pantries and some like the local nurseries. Like I know the church up on the corner, I think it's called Morning Star, and a couple other churches, they do have pantry days, like on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and they also feed the community on Wednesdays. So it's a work in progress, you know.
Can one farm and one garden be a solution?
For right now, that's what is happening. We plan on building more of these, but we're going to help as many as we can.
Well, Keisha, just hang on with me, okay? Because I want to turn to someone else now.
Okay.
I'd like to talk to Greg Garbos. He's an engineer by training and now an urban farmer by trade. Engineers work on systems, and the system Greg is trying to fix is the food system. He's with us from City Bitty Farm, a 2-acre farm where he grows microgreens year-round in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Greg.
Yep.
Whoa. That was a surprising greeting.
I'm excited to be here.
City Bitty Farm, where is it?
We are in southeast Kansas City, kind of down near the old Bannister Mall, a couple houses up from the Oakwood Country Club.
And you grow microgreens in high tunnels. What are high tunnels?
Yeah, there's a lot of season extension structures, to use fancy terms. But basically, greenhouses, high tunnels are ways to have a frame, wooden or steel frame. You stretch UV-resistant plastic over it, and it helps you control the condition inside of it. Mother Nature is mad at us, I think. And so the more we can control our conditions through temperature, humidity, watering, the better control we have of the plants and the better products that we can produce.
And what about microgreens? I mean, anyone who's been to a fancy restaurant has probably noticed microgreens on the menu, but I'm not sure everyone knows what a microgreen really is other than small and green.
Yeah, what's fun is probably a lot of people who are listening have eaten our products, right? We're in 50 restaurants. So if you go to a nice restaurant and there's a tiny little leaf on top of a steak, we are probably the ones who grew it. There's about 30 different varieties that we grow, from micro arugula, micro kale, red vein sorrel, and different things have different flavor profiles. So a lot of times it's used by high-end chefs as a garnish. Other times it's used because it's the most nutritious form of vegetables in that tiny, tiny stage.
You started out by making tools for growing food in all seasons. Tell me about that.
I think I started out by saying, yep, because I'm excited to be here. No, so I think that the food system is broken. I think that it needs a lot of work. I think it's going to happen from big ag kind of reaching down and from the grassroots effort pushing up. And
what do you mean by broken? I mean, we've heard about food deserts a little bit and about people not having access where they live to good produce, but what was the problem that you were noticing?
Yeah, well, I think that my farm is also in a food desert, technically. We got some, you know, the USDA would define it as that. I think that food, the more regional food is, the more that our region is taking care of its own food system, the more food security there is. You know, the fact that we've read that average plate travels 1,500 miles, food travels 1,500 miles to get to the plate. If we can have a regional food system and a local food system, a more vibrant economy that supports our local folks, then we have there's less of a chance of something going wrong. To me, the fact that 5 million pounds of beef can get recalled and that company doesn't go out of business is mind-blowing to me. Food is this gigantic juggernaut of an industry. And I think there's a lot of people, including everybody sitting at this table right now, who really believes that we can make a better system.
Well, so growing food all year round is a big part of that in your mind?
Heck yeah. Yeah. So the way I think about it is that there's the outdoor growing season. And here we are at our latitude and longitude. We can get about 7-8 months of outdoor growing. If you use simple season extension techniques, whether it is high tunnels or greenhouses or even some lower grade stuff called low tunnels and row fabric, you can dramatically extend your season extension. So then suddenly we're looking at 10 months or 10 and a half months that you can grow. Then I think there's a kind of another level where you're really getting into year-round heated greenhouses. So City Bitty Farm has several greenhouses. We've gotten bigger and bigger and bigger over the years, and it's all heated, and we go 365. So last year we did deliver twice a week, every week, every Tuesday and Friday. I calculated we did 3,600 deliveries last year to local restaurants. So there's a difference between growing outdoors, season extension, and then growing year-round. But you're not going to do it without season extension structures and some simple technology. I'll also make the point that's the thing that I think the city as a municipality needs to really work on. I think one of the biggest things that's broken in our actual city urban environment is the zoning and building codes around season extension structures.
Explain that.
The city is looking the other way, and everything that I do on my farm is illegal.
So the city's looking the other way until you just said that on the radio.
I've had city councilmen out, state senators, the founder of the U.S. Green Building Council. You know, there are people out there that are roaring, you know, and I like to think of that I'm one of them. And there's an amazing, amazing community around.
So you're not hiding what you're doing.
Oh, I'm the exact opposite. Come on down.
Well, you studied to be an engineer. What is it that you are engineering here?
Well, I think so. I own several companies. A lot of the engineering is at a company called Four Season Tools, and we sell horticulture supplies through smallfarmtools.com. And what that is basically a way in which we can do product development and new technologies around season extension. So a real pioneer in movable high tunnels, so greenhouses that slide back and forth for organic food production. In fact, later on the show will be Kerry Rivard from K-State, and his predecessor, Ted Carey, was one of the people who really got me into season extension a decade ago now. It feels like yesterday, right? But we really do need to understand that we eat every day, so we need to have food production systems that allow us to eat every day. So we spent a lot of time prototyping tools. I spent a lot of time working on systems. There was a huge event on Saturday where we really talked about the scale of farms and getting the scale right.
Tell me about your background. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a small town called Mount Vernon, New Hampshire, where there's no traffic lights and a tiny little town. My dad was an aerospace engineer. My mom was a minister. So I grew up with a sharp analytical mind, but a desire to really make a difference with those skills. And I've spent my entire career in different forms of environmental engineering, from hydrogen fuel cells to hybrid technologies. And now I've found food.
Was this a farming community, this small town with no traffic lights?
No, not at all. Not at all. I would consider, you know, kind of had a woodsman-like upbringing. We were deep in the woods. I grew up on 20 acres. We had 300,000 acres of woods behind our house, probably. Very, very rural upbringing. And I think one of the reasons I love food is that I believe that rural America needs a lot of help. And when we talk about urban farming, I think there's a lot of kind of, again, grassroots efforts kind of going up. But I really think the system is changing. And a lot of it is changing from the larger rural farms starting to penetrate that kind of philosophy and more of a business mentality into our urban environments.
What do you mean by that?
So the fact that there's only a couple farms in town that are even doing six figures is kind of mind-blowing to me, right? So a lot of the scale of the farms are kind of, you know, amazing efforts, amazing things dealing with social justice issues in food, from food deserts to access to food systems to healthcare. All those things are getting dealt with. But, you know, if there's 2.5 million people in Kansas City, there's 7 or 8 million meals being eaten every day. And less than 1/1000th of 1% of that is grown here. So the small is so small and the big is so big that the small can grow by several orders of magnitude and just be the fly in the turd of Monsanto. You know, the food is so huge. It's so gigantic. And we are just scratching the surface at this at the urban level.
How did you start thinking about this? I mean, did you know when you went into school to be an engineer that food was the direction you were going, or did something happen?
I think I've always been in the environmental side of engineering. I have a big love for Mother Nature, right? Treat your mother right. I always believe that. And so I think I've played in a lot of different things around engineering and the environment. And I think when I found food, it was this beautiful kind of collision between my life desire to use skill-based service. Whatever talents you have, use them to make the most difference you possibly can in the world. And then food is also interesting because of the sphere of influence. It's a place where a handful of people can really make a dramatic difference in a system that really needs a lot of help.
What do you think is the future of urban farming? I mean, is this a trend or an industry? You mentioned that there aren't many places in town doing more than six figures.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's 50 to 100 urban farms, depending on the definition. When there's the urban farm tour put on by Cultivate Kansas City, there's usually 36 to 50 farms on that tour, give or take, right? So there's a lot of initiatives going on. I'm excited to see a lot more kind of business and financial sustainability come into it. If you're really trying to be sustainable, you know, I really think you need economic viability, or else you have to get that funding from somewhere else. So the future is here.
We've got to take a short break. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear how these trends fit into the big picture of urban farming today. Plus, someone who grew up farming weighs in on what he sees in all of this. His father was a sharecropper in Arkansas. Now he's growing food in KCK. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we've been hearing the stories of urban farmers in Kansas City. Keisha Johnson of Nile Valley Aquaponics, who's growing tons of produce to feed a community that needs it in the urban core. And Greg Garbos, the engineer trying to change the food system with microgreens and tools for year-round growing. Have you grown food in the city? Do you want to? Call 816-235-2888 with your questions or observations about urban farming today. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. Now let's talk to Carrie Rivard. He's the director of K-State's Research and Extension Center in Olathe. Hi, Carrie.
Good morning.
So as Keisha and Greg talk about their farms and their personal journeys into food growing, do you hear pieces of a larger story?
Absolutely. You know, one of the things, especially when Keisha was talking earlier, is that some of the issues that we've seen surrounding food in terms of obesity and nutrition and public health issues surrounding our food system, we see those symptoms most acutely in urban areas. And I think a lot of the reason that we see that is because so few people anymore have a connection with where their food comes from. You know, 100 years ago, everybody grew their own fruits and vegetables. They had a pig or cattle or whatever, and they knew where their food was coming from. But we've lost a lot of our connections with that, and it's really interesting to see people, and especially children, make connections with these, and they start appreciating where their food comes from. And like Keisha was saying, you know, it's so easy to talk a child into eating kale and tomatoes and other healthy things when they've grown them.
You know, people have been saying this, that we don't know where our food comes from, for a while now. I mean, I feel like I've been hearing people say that at least 15 years. And in that time, a 15-year-old has had an entire lifetime. You know what I'm saying? I wonder if your idea of what it means, what we mean when we even say that, has changed.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, everybody has a different idea of what food is, right? You know, I mean, is it the fruits and vegetables? Is it the junk food at the gas station? It definitely makes a difference, sort of the perspective that you're coming from.
What are some of the unique challenges of farming in an urban setting?
Boy, there's a lot. one of the big issues that people think of oftentimes when they think of urban farms is soil. Because you're growing on city lots or places that have been previously developed, you may have not necessarily contaminated soil, but certainly poor, compacted soils with high clay content. And then in certain cases, you oftentimes have contamination by heavy metals or brown fields and some of those kinds of things.
How would someone who's just getting started on some land that for whatever reason they have access to know whether that soil is contaminated?
Well, you can find some of that information in public records. So you can track down some of the land history, you know, from the county. The other thing is there are people out there that can help determine that. So K-State has a group on campus who researches heavy metal contamination in soils, and they're able to do soil testing to look for lead, arsenic, other things.
So you wouldn't just recommend being like, what the heck, I'm doing it?
No, not necessarily. The research is still a little scant on, you know, what the impact is of growing in contaminated soils. Oftentimes the plants perform very poorly. There's not a lot of evidence right now that necessarily a lot of those heavy metals are moved into the produce itself. But what tends to happen is they just don't produce well, and so it's hard to deal with that. But there are testing facilities, and K-State has one where you can send a soil sample in and get it tested for those things.
Are there other challenges that you want to draw our attention to?
Yeah, you know, one of the big ones I think a lot of people don't realize is the importance of water. And, you know, water, we all need water to grow those plants and to grow those crops, but don't forget you also need water to wash those crops. And FDA and FSMA are starting to impose food safety guidelines on farmers, whether they're urban or rural, right? And so they're going to have to be washing those crops with potable water. And that gets very expensive if you're buying it from the city.
Okay, so those are some of the challenges. What about opportunities? And I mean, thinking about opportunities, not just of location, but of this moment.
Yeah, well, like Greg said, the market is ripe right now. There's tons of people that are looking to buy local produce. There's lots of organizations looking to support projects that help people connect with food. And so, you know, the opportunity is wide open for people doing this kind of work. Absolutely.
What do you see going on in and around Kansas City in particular?
Well, one of the things that I think is unique about Kansas City is because we have such a very large metropolitan area with a lot of land, quite frankly. We take our graduate students every fall out of Kansas City to learn a little bit about urban agriculture at K-State through this class that we have called the Urban Food Systems Study Tour. So last fall, we went to Seattle. We went to 20 sites in Seattle. The fall before that, we went to Chicago. And every time I come back from these trips, I think, and you know, it gives me a chance to see what's going on out there and reflect a little bit about us. And one of the things I see in Kansas City is we are actually doing a very good job of growing food in the city. There's a lot, if you go to more densely populated cities like Seattle, there's a lot of sort of urban agriculture initiatives going on, but they're mainly surrounding community gardens and other things like that, and distribution centers and stuff like that. But we have a handful of people actually growing, you know, a decent scale of food here.
So not
in
just
the city.
A plot for their own consumption.
Correct. Right. Right. People like Greg, people like Neil Rudisill up at Woodland City, and Nile Valley and others who are able to actually feed a community off of their space.
Are most of the people doing this doing it for profit or as part of a lifestyle or to try and solve the bigger problems in the food system?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of all of the above. You know, life works on a continuum, right? So there are some folks that are very profit-minded, very business-minded, you know, looking to make money to run a family farm, and there's folks that are running non-for-profit farms, organizations like the Giving Grove who are planting trees all over the city for the help of supporting communities that are underserved.
I've sometimes wondered whether people who come from like a rural farming background, people who have been doing this forever, would look at some of the city kids jumping into this these days and have a good chuckle, or if it might be more of like a, you know what? Like, right on. I can relate to this. Do you have a sense of that as someone who is part of an agricultural extension but doing all this research into urban farming?
Yeah. I mean, to be honest with you, 5 or 10 years ago, I probably was one of those people. I grew up in rural Kansas City. We have a little greenhouse business in my family. We always canned and, you know, grew all our own vegetables and those kinds of things. And then I did my training in North Carolina where they have lots of, you know, fruit and vegetable production and stuff, but it's out in the rural areas. And so when I first came here to K-State, I was kept hearing about this urban agriculture thing. I was just like, what is this? I don't really know. But
what did it sound like to you before you knew?
It sounded a little bit like, you know, people trying to grow food in the city, I guess.
But you were having a chuckle at it?
I wouldn't say a chuckle. My department head's probably laughing in her office right now if she hears this. But it was a little bit harder for me to understand the value of it. Because where I came from, my perspective was we need to be scaling up everything we're doing so that we can grow more fruits and vegetables to help feed our local communities.
Feed more people.
Exactly. Exactly.
And urban sounded like small scale because obviously space.
I don't get too caught up on the urban word, to be honest with you. I think you can interchange urban with suburban, with peri-urban, with local, with regional. There's lots of words you can use. But I think one of the things that I've come to appreciate is the value of that connection that urban farming has with people. And, you know, there's so many people growing up in rural Missouri, I didn't understand that people had never grown tomatoes before. That was a new thing for me. And so after I came to appreciate that a little bit more, I find a lot more value in some of those maybe non-financial aspects of the work.
I want to talk to someone who might also be able to help us out with this one. Sam Davis is both new to this whole thing and someone who's been doing it a long time. Sam, good morning.
Good morning.
So tell me about your history with farming, because you run a farm program now in the city, but a farmer is something you told yourself you would not be.
Right. Well, as you know, my father was a sharecropper when I was younger, so I just didn't want to farm from messing around with the cotton, the corn, and things. By the time I was 9, 10 years old, I knew I wasn't going to do any farming. I didn't.
What had you seen that made you think, nope, not for me?
Well, it was the first thing was how early you had to get up in the morning. You know, my father was one that at 4 o'clock you was up and you was on your way to the fields. This was what you had to do, and this is what it was. So I just, after it got to the place to where I thought I could hide or not go, that's what I started trying to do.
So what made you change your mind?
Well, as life goes on, I became retired. I was working as a millwright, and all of a sudden I was retired. I didn't have anything to do, and some of my old friends was gardening, growing purple hull peas. And I love purple hull peas, so he told me, you need to grow your own peas, because I was constantly getting from him. And I got started on a little small plot at the house, and from that, my brother-in-law came along and decided he wanted to do something, so we got another little plot and started growing. And I grew a little bit of everything just to grow it. Gave me something to do since I was retired, to get up in the morning to hit it. And from that, I've been started ever since. It's been about 12 years, so I've been growing ever since then.
Do you like it?
I love it. It gives me something to do. It wakes me up. You know, I mean, once season starts, that's all I know. I'm there at 4 or 5 o'clock. I'm up. I'm ready to run. I'm at the garden until late. It's life. You know, I mean, it's something that keeps me going. If the plants are growing right, the people I deal with, they're at the garden, at the farm. So,
tell me about Juniper Gardens Training Farm, which you run.
Well, I don't actually, that's what everyone says, I run it, but I don't actually run it.
If everyone says you run it.
Yeah, I'm just the site manager there. I put in a lot of time there, but this is one that it's the love of my life right now. It's like the wife, you know, I have to maintain her, take care of her. But I've been there ever since 2008, and I started helping a young lady that lived in my neighborhood.
Where is it?
Juniper Garden is at First and Richmond, and it's sitting in the middle of the oldest project, I'm told, in Kansas. So it's on the northeast side. When they speak of food desert, it is the northeast side is a food desert. And I didn't understand food desert when I first got into this, but there's not a supermarket within a 50-block square radius in this area in which I live in, you know. So now I know what a food desert is. But
you live there and you hadn't that wasn't something that you thought about, or?
Nah. And it, I guess for me, it's because of my upbringing. See, we always, whether I was growing or not, when my parents was living, my mother, my grandmother, they still can. And my grandmother lived to be 93. My mother was 87. So they still can and did certain things. And this is what we'd go and grab. My grandmother always had a little small garden on the side of her house. My mother would grow tomatoes and okra, just particular things on the side where the water comes down out of the gutter, where they didn't have to water it, things of that nature. So we didn't think of it as a food desert because my father was a hunter, fisherman, so we always had these things there at the house to eat and just never thought of it as a food desert, you know.
So what happens at Juniper Gardens Training Farm?
Well, Juniper Garden is, it's like it's a family. And what happens is we have 16 farmers growing on approximately a quarter acre. And it's a four-year program in which they go through. Most of our farmers are refugees right now through the New Roots program. We've had at Juniper, since we've been in existence, we've had six American people come through the program. Only one of them graduated from the program.
What does it take to graduate?
It's a four-year program, and all it takes is just to go through the 4 years, just to make it through the 4 years, and that's it. You're off into a business. And what it teaches you right now, what we're trying to teach them, is a farm business. So Cultivate KC has the part in which I work for there, Juniper, the gardening part.
So that's the organization that operates Juniper Gardens.
Right. And New Roots, which is under Catholic Charity, they take care of the business end of it for the young ladies we have in the program. Well, everyone is in the program now in terms of the English, math, getting their citizenship, getting to market, showing them how to, which most of our farmers know how to market. They just don't know how to market in America, and the things in which we have to do is totally different. So it's like retraining them or getting them in a position of where they can go to market on their own, sell to whoever, you know.
Between seeing what the people in this program who you're training to be farmers on some scale are doing and hearing what our other guests are up to on other urban farms in Kansas City, how does this compare to what you grew up watching your dad do?
Well, it's kind of hard to compare because what my father was doing was, truly hard work. I mean, it's not something that I would say that someone would like to do, you know, in terms of sharecropping, because you have to work for yourself and the person in which you are working for, and that's a hard struggle, jumping from place to place, because, but when what we have now is, I think this is a easy thing. It's just trying to get the farmers acclimated into the business thing. Growing it is all right. The pleasure part of growing is beautiful, but
the business is tough.
I listen to some of the things they say, and I think we can have too many farmers for the markets in which we have. There's many avenues in which they can sell their vegetables or whatever, but it's a tough business trying to get into it. You're a small person, and as Greg has said, you must have some type of income. There are other avenues in getting, but in this business, you got to have an income, too.
So I guess I kind of hear you saying that there are too many people doing it for the market, but that none of them, not many of them anyway, have, like, the scale to make a go of it.
I wouldn't say the scale so much. I would say that it's for the farmers, for turning out so many urban farmers, that means that we have to have urban markets. So how many markets can we have in places? This is the problem. All of a sudden, at one time, I believe, right, in Kansas, we had maybe 4 or 5 markets. And right now, there's probably 20 or 25. So
each one's serving like 5 blocks or something.
Well, no, they're scattered out a lot more than that.
More than that.
Yeah, quite a bit.
Let's talk to Dina in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Dina.
Hi, good morning.
What do you want to share?
Well, I just want to share that, well, first, it's good to hear Sam. Sam is part of the Kansas City Black Urban Growers called KC Bugs. And those are some of the growers on Kansas City, Missouri side and Kansas City, Kansas, who are black and brown growers who are doing everything from urban farming to aquaponics in their neighborhoods. And they come together and really try to educate in the neighborhoods around urban farming and urban ag. And also, I just wanted to point out a very successful urban farming program is called the Grown in Ivanhoe Project, which is in the Ivanhoe neighborhood. It's been around since 2010, and they actually started repurposing vacant lots. And from that time, they now have several acres of land. They actually grew growers in that neighborhood. They were taking people who live in the neighborhood, training them from everything from seed to plate. And out of that became the Ivanhoe Farmers Market. And you have people there who are buying land, repurposing just, you know, to grow for themselves, but also for the market, also to give back to the community.
Dina, thank you so much. Carrie Rivard, I want to hear from you about this because we just had Sam telling us that there is a real density of with these neighborhood markets, these neighborhood places where people can sell what they've been growing, and that it might be reaching oversaturation. We're also hearing Dina really excited about the market that she likes in Ivanhoe.
Yeah, so that's a great point, and it's kind of an issue that Kansas City's trying to get at right now. So as Sam mentioned, over the last 5 or 10 years, the number of farmers markets, direct-to-consumer markets has really, really sharply increased, and we're starting to see some of our farmers, like Sam mentioned, say farmers market sales are down. You know, we're starting to saturate that particular market. So there's been this initiative in both Kansas City and Lawrence for the last about 3 years now to develop what's called a food hub. So a food hub is basically a aggregation facility where many growers can bring their products together, put them onto a semi-truck, and send them to a school or an institution.
Well, we're going to get right back to this conversation about urban farming when KCUR's Central Standard returns. We're going to get these farmers in a little bit of conversation with each other, and we'll maybe hear from you too. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman talking about urban farming on KCUR's Central Standard with Keisha Johnson of Nile Valley Aquaponics on Kansas City's east side, Sam Davis, site manager at Juniper Gardens Training Farm, Greg Garbos with City Bitty Farm, where they do microgreens using all seasons technology, and Carrie Rivard, who is the director of K-State's Research and Extension Center. Now, I am interested in knowing, Keisha, you are a beginner at this, and you're working on Kansas City's east side. You're trying to feed a community on land that's been in your family. We've been hearing from Sam Davis, who has gotten away from farming over the course of a lifetime and come back to it in his retirement years. But he has this long history. And I wonder if you have any questions for Sam.
Well, I love Sam. I've been to his huge garden. It's what is it, an acre or two? Three?
Well, Juniper is 8 and 2. Stowers 2+, Juniper's 8+.
Yeah, I was fascinated to see the different types of soil that he had. He had like pink and yellow and green. I'm like, what is this for? He was like, and then I know Dre was like, it's expensive. I was like, okay, we need to get some of that stuff. And I found a couple of other gardens too that had a fig tree. And I think I'm just like, you know, I'm just excited about growing and learning more. Like, you can never learn or know too much, you know what I'm saying? So, me, I think I've been to your garden as well. You are out south?
Yeah, Southeast, yeah.
You had, I think you gave us some edible flowers last year.
Yeah, we grow edible flowers as well, yeah.
Yes, we had a chance to taste those until the kids, well, those goats, we call kids. They got a hold of them first, though. But, I mean, I'm excited about meeting and venturing out, learning from everyone here.
The goats had a fancy salad.
Those goats.
Greg, do you have questions for Sam?
I want to just thank him for his soul. You know, there's a ton of things I'd love to learn from him and stuff, but every time I've ever been around him, he glows. He's so alive. And I think it's really important to understand the community that does exist. They mentioned the Giving Groves. They just planted 80 trees on our farm to help our community in our food desert. You know, there's people out there like Roger Kuby at Stonycrest Farm and Alicia Ellingsworth with Casey Healthy Kids and Ami Freeberg at Longfellow Farm and Jason Fields with Urban Farming Guys. Amazing community, and we're all here together. So, Sam, I just think you kick butt, man. You totally kick butt.
Thank you.
Lots of love for Sam. Well, let's hear from Jeff in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be with you.
What can you share?
Well, you know, I have a 2-acre urban farm in Northeast, and one of the things that Kansas City really facilitates is relatively inexpensive land. And so I highly encourage people who are interested to engage Land Bank and learn more about being able to acquire land. But with respect to soil toxicity, we've been working with the Missouri Department of Conservation to get elderberry and some other native fruit varieties, which don't really take up any of the heavy metals. So there are some options for dealing with questionable soils that...
Like there are things you can grow where it doesn't matter?
Yeah, most fruit trees are impervious. The leaves you can bioremediate by gathering the leaves and removing them, but the fruits themselves don't take on the heavy metals. So there are some options in terms of orchards that people can use, these brownfields or these kind of waste fields, if you will, that wouldn't be good for leafy greens or tubers, but are really good for fruit trees. And so there's quite a bit of scientific inquiry along those lines, and so it's been demonstrated that definitely with elderberry, so you don't have to worry about the soil toxicity so much, especially the heavy metals.
Jeff, about the relatively inexpensive land, it sounds, I mean, there's an investment of finances in land to some extent, but there's also an investment of time and energy if you're going to do something with that land, and I'm curious if you know who it is who is buying up land with the intention of growing, other than, you know, like people doing large scale businesses. Who else is doing this? Why?
Well, one person is Jenna Wilkins, M&M Gardens. I know she's been acquiring some parcels, and she runs the Northeast Farmers Market on Independence Avenue. And so she's an example. There are other people out there, and like myself, for example, I try to acquire land in Northeast whenever I have an opportunity to do so. The lots are between, I mean, I'm not sure what land, I really haven't worked with Land Bank much. I used to work with Land Trust quite a bit. And so you can get vacant lots for between $400 and $1,500. You know, that's like a quarter acre to a third of an acre.
Let's talk to Carrie Rivard. Carrie, what do you see in this realm? I mean, people buying up land, not just growing on land they happen to have access to.
Well, one of the challenges there that oftentimes people forget about is that when you're a farmer, you have to live by your crops, right? And so there are some folks...
Sam is clapping.
there are some folks that are buying small parcels of land or renting or acquiring them, and I've seen those here as well as elsewhere. But for the most part, people are out looking for a parcel that they can farm with 3 to 5 acres, maybe less, maybe more. One of the things I was thinking when Jeff was talking is there's a really neat program in Lawrence called Common Ground, and they actually put together, and I'm gonna get the details wrong, I'm sure, but there's municipal properties that they're actually letting people use for any type of growing food, whether it's a community garden or an urban farm, and that's been a fairly successful program.
Sam, what inspired you to applaud at the statement that you've got to live near your crops?
Wow. Well, everyone likes to eat. So if you're not living by where you can protect your crop, there's individuals that just go in and help themselves. You know, since Juniper Garden has been existing. We have people just drive in and get out of their car and just start picking. They don't ask because they said they heard that it was a community garden and you could just come and pick. Well, I don't think anyone just other than now just say come and pick. You know, when you're the person that's doing all the work and invested your money in it. So if you can't protect your property, it's a bad investment. And we've had some of those things happen in Kansas where the farmer graduated and took a piece of property that they didn't live by. And people just ramshackled, I mean, drive the motorcycles.
Well, Sam Davis from Juniper Gardens Training Farm in KCK, thank you so much. And Keisha Johnson from Nile Valley Aquaponics, thank you.
Thank you.
Greg Garbo, City Bitty Farm, it's been a pleasure.
Yep.
And Carrie Rivard, Director of K-State's Research and Extension Center.
Thank you.
You can listen back to this conversation at kcur.org/centralstandard. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, and Andrea Tudhope. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to date's next.